Welcome to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And it's that special day, right?
It is. It's happy, happy Valentine's.
Valentine's Day. There are people listening to this program today, choosing from all of their array of perfumes, right? I have strong memories of my mother's dressing table with these perfume bottles on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure Valentine's was a complicated day to try to decide exactly which potion was the
magical one.
Yeah, I thought they were all kind of noxious myself, but that was tough. I think Halston was what she wore most of the time.
Wow. Mm-hmm. My mom's a lot older than yours, so it was definitely not Halston. I remember L'Air de Thon.
I'm sure it was better.
Uh huh. Mm-hmm.
There was a deep 1973 tone to my mother's perfume.
Yeah, I think my mom still had hers from the 60s sitting on that mirrored, beautiful little mirrored thing that it was on her dresser.
Had the little powder ball
women,
on the end there.
There were all kinds of magical, special things happening with those perfume bottles.
Yeah, it's the kind of stuff you spray right in your little brother's ear. Happy Valentine's, Clark.
Poor Clark.
Exactly. That's no wonder he enjoyed military school so much with brothers like that. So besides those kinds of potions.
Mm-hmm. There's some other good potions.
We're meant to speak about other potions for Valentine's, right?
Mm-hmm.
Potions and preparations and passions.
Right.
Right?
Well,
that's a lot.
I have a passion for cooking. Big one.
You think?
I do. So it's I think that that's one of the things about cooking is that it is a very central thing, actually, in the end, because it is all about the senses, both eating and cooking is. You use all of them. It's actually, in a professional way, it's one of the first things I tell my cooks is that you are about to heighten all of your senses because that's one of the greatest gifts that you have besides your hands when you're cooking. You know, one of your best tools are your hands and your ability to see, taste, smell, feel, you know, all of these things, these wonderful gifts that we have are what make us excellent cooks. And the more heightened those senses are, the better cook you are. And obviously the taste one is one of the most important, but we need all of them. We need our food to be beautiful and it needs to have a great texture and it needs to have many different textures and for it to be interesting and different tastes. And so all of these things come together. And I mean, it's funny because there's so many things about cooking that is a labor of love too. So, you know, there are a lot of things that in a serious statement.
Not in a cliche way.
Not being goofy.
I'm doing this because I'm doing this with a lot of care because I'm doing this to share it with you, person X, that I have, you know, many red candies for. Right?
Yes. Yeah.
The same way that, I mean, and it's not the same kind of labor of love as cooking for your child or your grandmother cooking for you when you're a child or something like that. So that's, to me, it's funny. One of the things about Valentine's Day, because it's such a big restaurant day as well, is that choice that people make. Do you want to entertain someone at home, at your collective home or at your place, or are you entertaining someone out? And, you know, how are you going to make that expression? You know, what style choice are you going to make? If you're making something at home, is it this elaborate thing that you've worked on bits and pieces of all week long and have been setting a table for days and all this kind of thing?
Well, that's what I was thinking.
That's what's in your mind.
Yeah, it is. It's exactly what I was thinking about. It's like there are many, obviously a million different approaches you could have when you're cooking for someone at home. But I kind of came up with two broad ones. One is the idea of doing a meal that's very, very elegant and beautiful, and the idea of doing a progressive picnic. which I think is a lot of fun. You know, a kind of, I think age differences and cultural differences are what are going to, you know, be the deciding factors on you're going to handle this day.
So let's go to the, you said a very elegant meal, so a very classical meal.
Mm-hmm.
So what?
And I don't think you want to eat a lot of food. So, but, and you know, a lot of things that I think of as, that are, can be very elegant can be a little bit rich. So I'm thinking actually three courses.
You would never cook something rich.
Uh-huh. So, yes, I would actually. And with my my love for French cooking, you know, and I was thinking a beautiful way to start would be with a shrimp bisque. And it's something that, you know, I'm trying to think of things that are accessible for people. And I am finishing with a course that is somewhat inaccessible, but, you know, you can't go to the regular grocery store and buy this, but you can certainly get it online. And that would be doing a beef Wellington for the last course. I think that the idea of cooking for two people is making the food for two. So having the last course be something that is portioned for two, that is sliced and shared, you know, and of course I think of that in the restaurant, but I think it would also be very nice in the home. You know, you are, after all, cooking for two people.
So let's give people a really sound shrimp bisque recipe and a couple of garnish ideas, because
mm-hmm.
this should be the very achievable thing.
That's what I think.
The Wellington is marvelous and a dangerous thing.
Right. Well, I can give an alternative. I'll give an alternative to that.
I think
you should give, what are you up to?
You should give the Wellington, because the Wellington's a big risk-reward dish.
Well, I'll give both. I'll give
but
two.
Let's have the shrimp bisque recipe first.
So the shrimp bisque, you know, you can go two ways. You can either just use the shells, and which means that you could have eaten the shrimp the day before for some other, for your family, or in another way. So you can either just make a shrimp stock, or you can use the shrimp, and or you can do both. that is what I'm going to tell you to do. So peel the shrimp and devein the shrimp. You do not want that vein in there. It's their digestive tract, so you're going to have sand and bits of undesirable things in that. That's why we take the vein out. So take all the shell off, devein the shrimp, just rinse it off quickly underneath the cold water. And I would buy a smaller shrimp, say even a 16-20, and that's not that small of a shrimp, but I use U10s, U12s, which are the biggest shrimp you can buy typically.
By 16-20, you mean a 16-20 count per pound.
Right. So there are between 16 and 20 shrimp that make up a pound. So it denotes the size. And so take the shells and put them in a pot just covered with cold water, bring it up to a boil, turn it off and strain it. And the shrimp themselves, you can just leave them as they are now. And put, for two people, I would do probably 14 shrimp. So saute one small shallot, a small dice of one small shallot in butter. Add, I would say, half of an onion in a small dice. Add that to the pan. Work it. Do not get any color, just until it's nice and soft, and maybe just before it begins to color. You should be cooking it on medium heat in a nice stainless steel pot, because you're going to be making everything in one pot. So saute the shrimp in butter. Saute the shallots in butter. Add your shrimp now. Have a little bit of flour ready to go, about a tablespoon, all-purpose flour. And when the shrimp are about halfway sautéed, add the flour to the pan. It's going to tighten up that little bit of butter that's still residual in the pan. And now you're going to make a choice. Do I want to add alcohol to this? If you don't, just add the shrimp stock.
Add the alcohol.
Yeah, well, I would, which I would do brandy or cognac, and I would add probably 2 to 3 ounces. You can choose to flame the pan, which means to ignite that alcohol and let it burn off, or to let it go, and that means you're going to have some residual alcohol in your soup. And then add, as I said, then you would add the shrimp stock and cream. And for two people, I would add 2 cups of cream. And
the shrimp stock is what you made with the shells.
Mm-hmm. And
that you strained off, and this would be pretty clear.
Yes. And it's not that, it won't be that much. I mean, you should only have about 4 ounces of shrimp stock. And that will, again, help to perfume and flavor the dish. And then I would add a pinch of cayenne pepper. You can choose to add a pinch of nutmeg. And and then let it all cook. And you want to let it simmer. Once it comes up to a boil, turn it down to a slow simmer and let it simmer on low heat for 30 minutes. You want to work that flour out of the soup, the flour flavor, the starch. You want everything to do its job. And you have to stir it pretty frequently or it will stick and scorch on the bottom of the pan. And that is the last thing you want. You certainly don't want it to burn. So let it go gently.
If you didn't cook the flour long enough, it tastes kind of gummy, doughy, right?
Right, right. And there's not that much. If you only put a tablespoon in, you're not going to have that much flour.
If you have cooked it enough, you'll actually notice the soup has thickened up. The liquid has actually thickened up a bit.
And it helps to make the soup silky. It gives the soup shine. That's what flour does. And obviously, it's a thickening agent. That's why you've added the flour, not only to thicken the soup, particularly because you just added, 4 ounces of shrimp stock, which is water and has no consistency, and added cream, which is probably not quite thick enough for what you want. And the other thing about the soup is the reason I add the flour, and you can skip the flour if you have a gluten intolerance, and just reduce it down a little bit more and bring it to sauce soup consistency as you wish. So you can skip that step. But I'm going to strain out the shrimp. I'm not going to puree them into it. I'm not going to try to pass them through it. What I really dislike, the texture of the pureed shrimp, even if you blend the heck out of it in a fantastic blender, which would be a really high-powered blender, it just ruins the texture of the soup. So you're actually going to discard those shrimp. So when the soup is done, you're going to pass it through a fine strainer, what we would call a chinois or any kind of fine strainer that you have, and you're just going to discard anything that stays in the strainer. And now you're going to taste it, check it. You might want to add a little bit of freshly ground black pepper. Definitely check it for salt because we've not added any salt at this point. So this is the time to decide, it might need a pinch of salt. You may want it to have a tiny bit more alcohol, and you may want it to have a tiny bit more heat. It's up to you and your palate. If so, maybe add up just a tiny, tiny bit more of the cayenne. And that's the soup. And you can garnish it in many different ways. So we can talk about that.
It's funny. I think I was sad for a second about losing the shrimp. I was like, what happened?
But the flavor is there, and you will like the texture so much more if you just discard them. They become mealy, weird, and a blender just
mealy, strange. Weird.
Yeah, and we are talking
okay,
about.
I'm not
your
making
senses.
Shrimp salad now either because it's.
Oh, that's totally different. That is totally different. We've cooked.
They're
these
not
shrimp.
Too mealy, weird for a shrimp salad.
No. Oh, those shrimp.
The shrimp?
Yes. Oh no, they're not good for anything. No, okay. After they've cooked for 30, actually technically
they are dead.
40 minutes
they
at this
are dead.
Point.
Remove these shrimps.
Yeah, they're not. They need to go.
Okay.
They're
gone. Yep, out of the picture.
They're gone. Trash. Get rid of them.
Out of the picture.
You could garnish that soup, you could make a little cilantro cream for it. So creme fraiche with a little bit of finely chopped cilantro or pureed cilantro in it. You could add tarragon, freshly chopped tarragon. You could make a little oil with tarragon. You could add a little black bean relish as a garnish if that's something
nice,
that you enjoy.
Cool glass of Vouvray with it.
There you go. Yeah, we need to hear the wine part. So what are we drinking with it?
Well, it could be Vouvray either, sparkling or still.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be something that has pretty good acidity and a little bit of sweetness to it. But shrimp are always inherently a bit sweet.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a pretty natural, Chenin Blanc, the grape for Vouvray is a pretty natural match.
You want to buy a good shrimp to make this soup. I prefer domestic shrimp, and unfortunately we can't get fresh shrimp, so it will be frozen. But you want to get something that you think smells good, looks good, and obviously is therefore going to taste good. So do be aware of that. I would use heavy cream. There's some local dairies. The better the cream, the better the soup. The better the shrimp, the better the soup. It's
as
the way
always,
it is with
the
everything you cook. Yeah. So the more care you put into it, it really doesn't take that. I mean, as far as soups go, a soup could take an hour and a half to make. As far as soups goes, this probably is prep time from prep to finish, probably an hour or less. And you could certainly make it one day ahead.
That's a pretty reasonable holding soup, too.
Right. And let's say you're eating some oysters on the half shell.
Now you're speaking my language, all
so
right?
So you're standing I'm going to talk about the progressive
the shrimps
picnic
don't get
later.
Me
but,
too,
yeah, don't I get mean, you too excited.
Shrimps are nice, and shrimp bisque. People should be able to make a good shrimp bisque. And it's warming, and I'd like a glass of Vouvray with it. But you say oysters in the half shell, and I just think, okay, what kind? How many different kinds? The only problem with oysters in the half shell on Valentine's Day is, are you prepared to shuck?
Sure. Well,
you know, are you a shucker?
Yeah. Well, you may
want
to practice.
Do you have a glove?
Right.
Well, yeah. And
this is not the day to cut your hand.
Yeah. Don't guzzle two glasses of really good champagne. You know, Bollinger
or Esli
Oreille or something, or some great Blanc de Blanc that you've been saving for Valentine's Day. You finish half the bottle, and then I'm gonna open some oysters now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you just stab yourself.
That might
in the
be
hand.
The end of the romance. Yeah,
I'm certain the emergency room probably has the most amusing stories for Valentine's Day. I always think the restaurant has some amusing stories on Valentine's Day, but mostly it's very sweet.
Yes, yeah, sure.
Mostly
sure.
It's very, very sweet. And,
right.
But I'm sure that there are sweet but not so amusing stories, but you still want to hear them from the emergency room.
Yeah, I would suggest an oyster glove for sure, unless you're really good at it and you're not worried about it. And even then, I mean, we basically take a kitchen towel and wrap it around the center of our hand. Or you can do it with nothing on your hands. But a little glove, there's nothing wrong with it, and it will help to save you. And you do need to be careful because you're doing the ultimate thing that you should never do in a kitchen, which is, even though it's an oyster knife, you're pointing it towards yourself.
Driving a knife towards your hand.
Yeah, you always, anytime you're cooking, you always teach a cook to cut away from yourself, away from the body, away from your hand. But when you're doing an oyster, you have no choice. Or any time of shucking, you have no choice.
It takes force.
And
you
have
to, but you also want to save the oyster liquor,
the
liquid that's in that shell. And
for
that's,
sure.
I mean, making a little bit of mignonette or made recently a ginger mignonette for oysters that was just awesome. Just replaced it, did half shallot and half fresh ginger and not the black pepper and with the little bit of red wine vinegar and chive, and that was just amazing. A couple little drops of that on the oysters.
Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about just very far back in history for me, when we had a restaurant where I did really only Southern food. I used to make a bourbon-spiked cocktail sauce for oysters. And, you know, fresh cocktail sauce made, a little bit of horseradish, and you can either use fresh or you can use, we have some really great local producers of horseradish, prepared horseradish. So a little bit of prepared horseradish, ketchup, fresh lemon juice, and a little bit of bourbon. That's how I used to make cocktail sauce way back in the day.
Wouldn't it just be easy to make cocktail sauce and have the shots?
As you wish.
I'm just kind of saying.
As you wish.
And that sounds a little bit more like an oyster situation for a beer.
Mm.
I guess I was thinking about the...
Not as elegant.
Everyone has a different kind
of
Valentine's.
That's the thing. I mean, a lot of people love cocktail sauce with oysters.
Maybe there's some very interesting craft beer that you want to have.
There you go.
That would work out pretty well with the oyster, with the bourbon spike cocktail sauce.
Personally, I do like a drop of Tabasco on my oysters. It depends on the oyster. I mean, you know. If it's a good southern oyster, I definitely want to drop a Tabasco on there. A little lemon juice, maybe, or just straight out of the shell. But sauce mignonette is a great way to go, which what you were saying, the traditional sauce is roughly cracked black pepper, finely chopped shallots, and red wine vinegar. That is sauce mignonette.
Yeah, and a little chive.
Yeah, and a little chive or, yeah.
And all I did was sub out the black pepper for the...
Ginger.
A little bit of fresh ginger and just gives a little bit different perfume.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think oysters are fun. You know, again, you're doing something together, most likely. You know, you're working together. And you're getting ready for the next course. So you have something you can play with, have fun with, and enjoy immensely. We love oysters in this part of the country. And there, as you say, there's so many different choices, and we can get oysters from everywhere now.
Those Kumamotos you got recently were great.
Those are mind-blowingly good, and they're also gorgeous to look at.
The best I've had so far all year have been raspberry points, which are from way up north in Canada, from St. John's Island. And, oh, my goodness, they were great.
I mean, you can even buy what they call locals, which are really good. So
they can be quite delicious.
Yep, absolutely.
When we come back on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, we'll see if we can get past first course. On our Valentine's program, all of that and more on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And our topic is Valentine's, because it's Valentine's.
Woohoo!
Yep. We have the entire studio decorated with with hearts and
doilies.
And since it's Baltimore, pink flamingos. And I wish I could be promising an interview about Valentine's spirit with John Waters, but I can't.
Wow.
So we're just going to have to talk about the rest of the meal.
Okay.
That you, or meals you had in mind.
I do.
For.
I can't wait to get to the progressive picnic.
Well, you haven't even done main course.
I know. Well, and I have a salad too.
You had a
classical. So I was thinking it would be fun. Fun to have hearts of palm. Because the
ladies
word
and gentlemen,
heart.
Valentine's is seven installments. Okay. Okay. So
hearts of palm. Yeah. I don't know. You know, it just came to my head, and then
make,
I'm like,
can you make a pink? Can you make a pink dressing for
no.
Hearts of palm?
Well, we could use red wine vinegar. So okay. So and I think it's fun to make mayonnaise. I do think it's fun, and I think it's a good exercise for people to learn.
You should never allow anyone to isolate that quote. I think it's really fun to make mayonnaise.
Well, you know, I'm a chef. So
it requires a lot of passion.
A really good red wine vinegar. A really good red wine vinegar. And you need a couple tablespoons. And you need a neutral oil in this case. So we're going to use corn oil and salt and pepper and an egg yolk. And the best way to make mayonnaise by yourself, you know, not used to doing it, is in a bowl. Over a small pot that will hold that bowl in place for you. So, you know, you can do it with, because you're going to have to drizzle the oil in. Well, okay, so, I'm teaching you how to make it by hand. So, you could make it in a food processor or a blender.
So pot on the counter, bowl sitting comfortably in the pot.
Right. And I put a towel between, you know, underneath the bowl.
So they don't go flying around.
Right. So the bowl is stable. So you have a wet towel underneath the bowl that sits in the pot. And obviously you're on the counter. As you said, we're not doing this over heat. It's just giving you a station in order to make the mayonnaise. So you put the vinegar, red wine vinegar in, and please get a really good one. As I said, a little bit of salt, a little freshly ground black pepper, and then you add in your egg yolk and you whisk the egg yolk, and one yolk is fine for two people. And you'll probably need it about half a cup or finished product. So, I would have my oil in either a little measuring cup so it's ready to go and you know how much it is, and something that's easy to pour from, maybe a little plastic or glass measuring cup, a liquid measure so that you can pour it out easily. Or I use a ladle. I would use half a cup.
Okay.
And you need a small soft whisk. So and you can use this same kind of whisk for a million other things, like scrambling eggs or whatever. So it's not like it's a special piece of equipment.
So you got your egg yolk, you've been whisking it, and it's all worked in with the vinegar.
But don't overdo
and
it.
And the pepper.
Right. So just whisk it so it's incorporated.
Just
so
to where, egg yolk, just to where it's incorporated.
Right.
And then your step is you have
and
this
you
little
start
measuring
to
cup.
And drizzle in that oil. And literally your drops in the beginning. And it should be a tiny stream. You know, whisk, whisk, never stopping the whisking. A tiny stream of oil going
right,
into that.
Tired.
Yeah, you never ever. Yeah, Tony's mimicking the motion right now.
And, you said it was fun.
Yeah, it is fun. And so just the not fun part is it might break. So you may not stop whisking, and you may not add too much oil at one time. So those are the rules. And once it gets nice and thick, you're done. And taste it and make sure it tastes good. And it may need a little bit more salt, or it might need a touch more vinegar if you like it pretty acidic, which I do. This is a perfect foil for hearts of palm.
Pink mayonnaise.
It is going to be pink.
Because the
with your
vinegar.
Heart of palm, which is one of my favorite things to eat. And is very French and is a sort of a classic bistro dish, you know, from maybe the late, or early 1900s. Pretty traditional. You could put a little bit of mosh, lamb's leaf lettuce on the plate with it, just a little bunch. This is simple to do. Quite frankly, I'm probably going to shock people, but you can buy hearts of palm in the can. So it's pretty common. I will tell you that Brazilian hearts of palm are the best canned hearts of palm. That's what you want to look for. There's absolutely nothing wrong with buying them. Yeah, that's the way they come. I mean, it used to be you couldn't get them any other way, but you can buy fresh. No one will find it now, but you can buy it through purveyors.
There's an elegant way to present it with lettuce leaves and all sorts of business. Mm-hmm. There's also... you have your little pot of pink mayonnaise and you have spears of hearts of palm that you just dunk in there.
Exactly. I mean, it's just kind of fun and simple, and it's really easy to do. And, you know, you can make the mayonnaise ahead and cut the hearts of palm, have it in the refrigerator, have the lettuce ready to go. You can put this together in, you know, a minute. So it's something that's very simple, but it's crisp, it's refreshing, and it'll just be fun. And it'll be a nice thing after that shrimp bisque, because a shrimp bisque is going to be a little bit rich on your palate. So then you have this bright, acidic dish afterwards, and now you're ready for the Wellington.
So let's talk about the Wellington. So what is beef Wellington?
Traditional beef Wellington would have beef tenderloin wrapped in puff pastry, and it would have a foie gras mousse type thing inside of the beef tenderloin, and it's baked in the oven, and then it would be sliced and served.
So it's not just pieces of foie gras; it's actually the old school is either a mousse or foie gras pate,
mm-hmm.
that's slathered over top of, like, you have your beef tenderloin laid out in a long slice that's been seasoned, and then this is laid out on top, and the pastry wrapped around like it was prepared to be,
mm-hmm.
yeah, wrapped in a blanket.
So I'd make it a little differently. So what you want is the center of the beef tenderloin, what is referred to as a Chateaubriand, and because I'm going to ask you to butterfly it. And you don't want to butterfly it like so it's laid out flat. You don't want to cut it. So what you're going to do is cut it horizontally towards the edge, but you don't want to cut so far. You want to leave some of the meat on the left side, basically, of the tenderloin.
Allow me to translate.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're cutting a submarine roll.
Right. Okay.
It's sort of like that.
Yeah, it is. So just don't unhinge it, right?
And you don't cut it all the way across.
Don't cut it all the way across. So what you're going to do is, if you want to invest in a piece of foie gras, you would then cut the pieces of foie gras in about 1 ounce pieces, 1 ounce slices, and it needs to be cold before it goes into the pan. So once you cut it, you should then put it back in the refrigerator for a few minutes to make sure. You want to work quickly when you work with foie gras. You are 98.5 degrees about that. The foie gras is going to melt just from the touch of the heat from your hand. So take the foie gras out of the package, slice it, put it back in the refrigerator, let it get cold, and then get your pan hot. Once your pan is hot, with a tiny bit of neutral oil in the bottom of it, just enough to barely coat the bottom of the pan because the foie gras gives off enough fat, but it will stick to the pan if there's no fat in the pan to start. That pan should be to almost to the smoking point, so a very hot pan. Put the slices of foie gras in, sear them very quickly on both sides. Again, as always, I would say, do never overcrowd your pan. Never overcrowd your pan. It reduces the heat in the pan too much, and then it will not sear properly. So
you're just searing both sides, mm-hmm. and right out of the pan.
Right. And, you know, I would have, like, we would use a half sheet pan, but use some sort of a cookie sheet or something that you would have at home, or it can be a plate for all that matters, just to take it out of the pan and go on to something so it can sit while you sear the other pieces. If you have to do them, you know, you won't need that much because you're only cooking for two people. When I make it, I make a whole beef tenderloin, so it's very different for how I would do it.
So really honestly, hungry people.
So really, you should easily be able to sear those pieces in the pan. You're just going to do enough to line the interior of the beef tenderloin portion. And I would say you want 8 to 10 ounces per person. So beef tenderloin.
Beef.
So I would say you want about a 20 ounce piece of beef tenderloin, the center of the tender. And for that, I would say you probably need about 4 ounces of foie gras, maybe 6, depending on your appetite and how much you like foie gras. But this is a different way of doing it because—
God bless you.
Yes. Yes. So this is a different way of making Wellington, and I will add one more twist, and of course it throws it over the top expense-wise, but I'm just going to tell you because, you know, this is what I do, which is I layer in slices of fresh truffle. Fresh black winter truffle. This is the time of year for them, if you are so inclined. Once I've seared the foie gras and it's cooled, I put it into the center of the tenderloin. This tenderloin, of course, is seasoned lightly with salt and pepper. The foie gras should also be seasoned lightly with salt right before it goes in. And then I cover that foie gras with thin slices of truffle. I then close up, close the beef tenderloin, if you will.
Close the submarine sandwich.
Yeah, close the submarine sandwich. Boy, that's really bringing down an elegant thing. And
I just want people to be able to understand what you're talking about.
I got it. And the puff pastry, probably what you would buy at the store will be the right thickness. So let's just go with that. So you're going to you're going to need an egg wash, which should be an egg yolk with, a whole egg with just a little bit of water. So let's say one egg, one tablespoon of water whisked into a little bowl, and you need a pastry brush.
And you whisk that so it's sort of smooth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not apparent that there's white and there's yolk.
Right. No, it should be whisked together. And you're going to seal the pastry closed with that. So you're going to wrap the – it's a very
well, – you're going to lay a square down essentially or a rectangle, down.
A rectangle.
Are the pastry large enough? You better be good at wrapping holiday presents so that you can lay that tenderloin in there and mm-hmm. then wrap it. And when you do
–
then...
pull one side over, pull the other side over, and then tuck in the ends basically. Actually, I tuck them under. But what you have to do is you need to egg wash that first layer of pastry as you bring it over and close it, just pat it down, and then again egg wash the whole exterior. And then when you tuck the ends under, that will have a little egg wash on it that will help to close it. And you want it perfectly sealed. What's going to happen is a lot of goodness is going to happen inside that puff pastry. To me, sometimes the best part of the dish is the puff pastry, well, particularly the ends.
All of the foie gras steam through the beef.
Yeah, all the juice, all the fat, all that stuff goes into those.
If
that
you're lucky
pastry.
Enough to have the truffle,
yeah,
that perfume goes into the pastry
as well.
Yeah,
it's incredible. It really is. So now you've egg washed the entire outside. I put it on a rack on top of a sheet pan. So you need that pastry to... You could put it, if you're like, oh, I'm not buying a rack for my sheet pan. You could put it directly on a sheet pan, but it's just not going to behave as nicely as it should. So it needs to sit on something where the pastry can have a little bit of air.
Where the air circulates around
it
underneath.
It needs the hot air underneath it. So I do suggest that. And I would roast it at 350 degrees. If you have a convection oven, I would go ahead and put it on low convection. And Now comes the fun part, which is what you were talking about when we first started to talk about this dish. The trauma of this dish is getting the temperature right. And when you haven't made it before, it's everybody's oven is a little bit different. So it's easy to say 6 minutes per portion in this case, I would say. You know, it's about 6 to 8 minutes. So I would say it's about 16 minutes to do this, maybe 14 from start to finish.
To get it to around what temperature?
Medium rare.
And that's for a piece the size you're talking about.
Yeah. For 20 ounces.
20 ounce piece of beef.
Yeah, 20 ounces of beef tenderloin. Yeah, because it can only be so narrow. The meat can only be so narrow.
And when it comes out of the oven, you need to rest it for a few moments,
I would
right?
say at least 5 minutes, maybe eight.
Meaning keeping it in a warm place but not hot.
Right. Yeah, I would keep it in...
You don't want it to take
maybe
a chill.
Maybe next to your stove, if you have a table next to your stove, that's a perfect place. Or on top of the oven, you could put it. You can't do anything to it. You can't put foil over it. You can't, you know, you're just going to let it rest 5 minutes just because now I'm starting to get nervous in case your kitchen is cold or something. But let it rest for a few minutes before you slice it because obviously the blood has to redistribute back through the meat. All the juices need to do their thing.
You don't want to lose all of the juice
and the tenderness of the
beef and all the work that you did.
You could probably actually let it sit there for 15 minutes and it would still probably be okay.
And this is, if you make this, this is not a cheap dish, and I'm honestly not going to recommend a bargain wine with it. If you're making this for Valentine's, it's a big deal. And if you're listening to this on Valentine's and you're making this for tonight, you better hustle.
Right. That's why I'm going to give a quick alternative.
You got a lot of work to do. It's the time for a bottle of Grey Bordeaux that has a little bit of bottle age on it. If it doesn't, at least something that you want the power, you want the complexity, you want the freshness of the acidity of those wines. I don't think you want quite the alcoholic power or tannic power of the New World wines for this. You want something that's going to be a little bit more balanced to take on the dish and let the dish shine as well as the wine. There's enough fat and richness and intensity in the dish to take on any structure in the wine. The fruit that's there will shine through. I guess now, Cindy, I'm sure that you have a quicker version or a different version of an elegant main course that's not going to take quite that time investment.
Right. Or money investment, right.
If someone's going to try to get this done.
Today.
Valentine's afternoon. Anyway, we'll have that, more recipes, more Valentine wines. We return on Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine on WYPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And it's Valentine's Day.
Yes, exciting holiday.
We're celebrating in our elaborately decorated Valentine studios here at WIPR. It's amazing that they did this for today.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful.
I can't believe they have it all down by Monday. I guess, well, we'll see if they do or they don't. We'll hear all about it, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. So you had an alternative to the Wellington. We're running through Valentine's, an elaborate meal or entertainment. Wellington being sort of the pinnacle challenge, if you want to take that high risk, high reward sort of a challenge as a cook at home.
And an easier way to sort of deal with beef tenderloin, you could do slightly smaller portions and just saute it, or you could sear the large piece and roast it in the oven so it's a little bit out of sight, out of mind for a little while. And then just make, instead of doing the whole, you know, Wellington thing, just make a mushroom duxelle, which these are easy to find ingredients. A little bit of shallot, finely chopped. Button mushrooms, finely chopped, sauteed in a little bit of butter with salt and pepper until it's just about to caramelize. And once it begins to caramelize, you can, when you go to plate, you can put that little bit of the duxelle underneath the beef tenderloin. And if you have roasted it as a whole piece, just cut it into your two portions, sit it on the duxelle, and then make a very simple cream sauce of Madeira and cream with a little bit of salt and pepper in it. Just heat it up, reduce it down, and you can pour that around the beef tenderloin with the duxelle. The flavors go together really beautifully. If you do happen to have some stock, a little bit of stock reduction in that sauce makes it even prettier. But, I mean, you can make this very simply, and it doesn't take a lot of time, and you can find all of those ingredients, and then your investment is only in your beef tenderloin, really, which is an expensive piece of beef, but if you're going to do something special.
But it's Valentine's Day.
Yeah,
right,
if you're going to do something special. And you could always, you know, throw the whole thing over the top and forget everything I've said and add a lobster to the top of that, too. And it wouldn't be such a bad thing.
You
could
always
put part
this.
Of a lobster tail on.
You a live lobster. A live lobster on your beef.
You could put
Good luck with that.
Really, I don't think that would be very romantic. But a couple of medallions of lobster on top would be pretty good, too. So, but anyway, kind of blew my whole inexpensive alternative.
Is your Valentine Diamond Jim Brady? I'd like to have 100 oysters followed by tornadoes Rossini and a live lobster on top of beef tenderloin.
So the other idea was a progressive picnic.
Yes. So a picnic meaning now it's chilly on Valentine's.
Well, it's an indoor picnic. I just think it's fun. It's casual. It's
that
not,
sounds like
you
it
know,
has excellent romantic potential, the
indoor
picnic.
That's what I think.
Yeah.
That's what I think. I think it does. You know, the whole idea is you start in one place and you end up in another.
Oh, my.
Oh, gosh.
I don't know if you can
Did
use
I just
that.
Say that out loud?
I don't know if you can use that tone on National Public Radio.
But anyway, you start in the kitchen. So I think you should still start with those oysters
You probably are going to start in the kitchen.
and then you know, I think it would be fun to have just all different kinds of cured meats, which, again, we have some fantastic grocery stores in our area, and you can find these things, you know, whether it's Finocchiono or a
which is a big Italian salami.
Or a regular salami or, you know, just whatever it is that you like. Different types of hams and maybe porchetta. And, you know, just have all kinds of different things. Maybe have a couple, as we talked about earlier, have a couple of different types of oysters. And definitely have a little bit of cheese out at this point. I mean, you know, this is what we love in the United States. So why not go ahead and have it? And you can buy all kinds of good cheese locally. So, you know, have a couple of different types of cheese and definitely something that's maybe a cow's milk piece that's a little runny and pretty and something sheep's milk and, you know, maybe get a washed rind piece that's got some strong flavors to it to go with the meats and, you know, just have fun with it or whatever it is that you like. And then while you have all those things, you're going to have, hopefully, great
I'll tell
bread
you what,
out.
I'll tell you what I like is I like jamón ibérico, the great, great ham from Spain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just that and champagne and oysters. Have those out. And I'll say, I guess cheese would be better in the first room you started and then in the last, right?
Yes. you know, why not have that? I mean, I think that's the idea of a picnic is, you know, if you have started in the kitchen with your oysters, which have to be opened in the kitchen, so might as well just stand there and eat them while you're opening them and then go into the living room or wherever it is that you're comfortable, hang out, you know, and then sort of – and also have maybe some dried fruits, you know, whether it's figs and prunes and apricots and cherries and cranberries, all sorts of dried fruits and nuts. Those can all be laid out. These are all things, again, you can just set it all up ahead of time. You know,
you're setting us up almost like a trail.
I knew this was going to be difficult talking about with you, but anyway, I'm just going to keep going, forging ahead.
Hang on, I'm getting a powerful image.
Oh boy, I don't want you to have a powerful image.
If someone is shucking oysters, their hands are going to be too dirty to handle their own champagne glass, meaning that someone else is going to have to.
Oh.
Be pouring champagne into your throat.
Well, okay.
So maybe now's a good time to talk about a couple of good champagnes.
Okay, yes.
two wines, dollar for dollar, small growers that I think are fantastic. Real champagne. One is Gonet Medville, GONET-MEDVILLE. Several different wines from them. They make an excellent rosé. I think the Blanc de Noir is probably the best wine. Literally black, white from blacks. It's a wine that has a bit of a golden hue to it for champagne. It is not super duper expensive. It's not as famous as some of the other names that are out there. That's a big, rich style. Another house, if you like really moussey, I almost want to say zippy, citrusy, long, sharp, clean champagne, maybe great for oysters. Jean-Marc Selec is a very good small grower I've talked about before.
Yes. Yeah.
And he has a couple of different bottlings. The Cote d'Or is a great one. Just the regular non-vintage bottling from them is a great purchase. I would look at that as well. But that's a couple of champagne ideas for
that
oyster that someone is shucking for you that you can be pouring that champagne down their throat. So please, take us down the trail.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then I think that there should be some grapes somewhere.
Some grapes?
Grapes and maybe fresh, you know, more fresh, some fresh fruit. You've had dried fruit and things and breads and nuts with your cheese and your meats and all that stuff. And now we need some freshness. And so maybe you could have some sorbet planted somewhere as well. That's sorbet. What I'm thinking.
Are there costumes?
I think down, sorbet.
It's funny. You went from like
this
very involved, elegant meal. This very involved, elegant meal to something that, you know, essentially is like, you know, like waiting for someone to come around with a lyre, plucking a lyre.
that's pretty much what I was thinking.
Yeah, and trails of fruits off into various parts of your abode.
Well, there you go. I'm glad you said it for me, Tony.
I'm deeply impressed with the diversity of those ideas.
Mm-hmm. So what else can we drink? Oh, how should we finish up drinking?
This
kind of situation.
Let's instead of being completely silly for 2 minutes,
really?
What is a practical way to get fed during the progressive meal? Is there a main course that's the kind of thing that, like, because you've been fooling around for an hour or something with with champagne and oysters and
and
jamon and fruits and nuts. And so, seriously, a practical, like, let's say you've moved from the one room to the other room and you've been snacking, but you want something.
Yeah, I think a braised dish, you know,
want
that's
a plate.
Something
you
that's,
want a plate of something.
Right, you want something serious. So, you know, a braised dish is something that's in the oven that you know, don't have to worry about. It's not a critical dish. So, meaning something that will be cooked to a certain temperature or sautéed or something quickly. So, Blanquette de Veau is a very pretty dish and you know, you're just braising an off-cut of veal whether you use the shoulder or you know, just talk to your butcher and find something. And you would, one of the things about making blanquette is that it's supposed to be white. So you don't actually brown the meat. So it's sort of a little bit of an easier task to braise. So, you know, you're basically blanching your veal in stock and adding aromatics like carrots, leeks, shallots, onions, and You could add a little bit of button mushroom as a garnish to the dish at the end. But I think the carrots are very important, so you want them to be a, either baby carrots or a small carrot that you can have, you know, decent, like maybe the size of your finger or something, little finger. But you want to have real pieces of carrot in and the button mushrooms. And this dish is finished with cream. So once you're done braising it, you can add a little bit of cream to that braise and heat it up and reduce it down a little bit further, and that can be in the oven and ready to go. And
you could just be holding that in a 200 oven or something.
Exactly. And you could do, you could even have a little buttered noodle or a little bit of rice, whatever, again, you know, is your particular choice, and have that ready to go and
like
garnish.
Nice brioche toasts. Like butter brioche
toast.
That
would,
just do
that would
for
be
a
good because it would be done. Yeah.
I always want to put a couple of those on the plate. Mm-hmm. You know, it sounds ridiculous, but like as an American kid, like loving cream chip beef.
Oh, sure.
The best French version of cream chip beef.
Yeah, that would be pretty sweet, right?
Would be great. And it's easy. And if you want to go to red wine, then it can be really pretty Pinot. It can be Pinot from Burgundy. If you want to bank on Valentine's and some of the romantic French name, Chambon-Moussigny, something like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Easy to do Barbaresco with some age on it if you'd rather have something Italian. But you can easily keep drinking champagne, especially the richer styles.
That would be nice. But either way, but I think it's an easy way to have something substantial and not have to really deal with anything.
So is there any way to end other than with chocolate?
I don't think so. Not on Valentine. So... gosh, there's about a million different things you could make. You know, you could certainly make chocolate mousse, which is pretty easy to produce.
Read Julia Child's recipe and make it. It's good.
Totally. or a great flour.
If you listen to nothing else that we say.
A flourless chocolate cake, which is lighter in texture and is good at room temperature.
Or one of the great local chocolatiers. There are several who do good work.
Mm-hmm. Or you can make a chocolate crème caramel or chocolate crème brûlée. Well, that might be fun too, and then you can brulee it and
feeling chocolate and eggy at the same time.
Crusty thing, yeah. Wonderful sugar topping, and there's a lot of choices. Or if you just maybe have some great bonbons or truffles or something.
People always ask me about wine with chocolate. It's funny. Even my dad is like, chocolate and red wine meant to go together. Well, I think that not every red wine is meant to go with chocolate. I do think it's hard to put many whites unless they're crazy sweet.
Mm.
Wines from a little town, Banyuls, in the south of France.
Yeah.
Do great. Marie from down there also.
Mm-hmm.
Do great with chocolate dishes. Serve them a little cool, like you would most red wines. Say 60 degrees, something like that. Just not chilled, but cool. Makes a big difference. The alcohol is a little bit higher. Port can work very well. Tawny port in particular. Vintage port can be pretty tannic unless you have a lot of older stuff. And the older stuff, honestly, you may want to have that on its own. Madeira is probably the one white wine that does well with chocolate, and that's going to be pretty sweet and have pretty good acidity. If you have a pretty complex chocolate dessert that's very sweet, especially that has any citrusy elements or acid elements, Madeira, Malmsey Madeira, Boal Madeira can work really, really well. You can also, if the chocolate dessert is not so sweet, say the flourless chocolate cake you're talking about, if it's not that sweet, you could have a glass of really great fruity Red Zinfandel from the great 13 vintage from Sonoma County and be very happy about it. So I think that's all we have time for on Foreman Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
Thanks for listening. And if you want to follow Chef Wolf on social media,
you can follow me on Twitter at Chef Cindy Wolf or on Instagram at Chef Wolf.
And if you want to download this or any of the other podcasts of our program, go to the WYPR site, WYPR.org, and look up the Foreman Wolf page, and you can find this and all the other programs. Thanks so much for listening.
And happy Valentine's Day.